Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Today's episode is about sexual assault, so I would like to emphasize listener discretion. If you find this topic distressing, you may want to skip this episode. Imagine sleeping soundly as the rain patters against your bedroom window. It's cold outside, but you're snuggled in your warm bed, sound asleep, feeling completely secure. Suddenly, you're wide awake. Something touched you. There's a strange man looming over you. He's wearing a stocking mask, and you know instantly why he's there. This is how a 38-year-old Nashville attorney awoke in the chilly pre-dawn hours of March 1, 1994. Pat Young knew immediately that she would fight. And fight she did. Every time the man tried to grab her hands to bind them, she fought. He punched her in the face and head, and still she fought. They tumbled to the floor, and she fought, biting him numerous times. It was the only weapon she had. She managed to bite off a piece of skin on his finger, and thinking quickly, pulled it from her teeth and hid it under the bed. They struggled a bit longer until he abruptly stopped, pushing her into her bathroom, and then he fled into the night. Pat Young didn't know it at the time, but she had just become the first known victim of a serial rapist known as the Wooded Rapist, who would terrorize the Nashville area in three counties for 14 years before he would be brought to justice. And her quick thinking preserved his DNA. She would be the first of many survivors who were determined to save evidence of their attack. Robert Jason Burdick was meticulous and methodical. He left almost no other evidence at any of the scenes. In the end, the DNA these brave women preserved would be his undoing. Welcome to episode 44, The Wooded Rapist. Predator Jason Burdick became known as the Wooded Rapist because all of the homes where he attacked were near tree lines or woods. One was even close to a creek. All of these homes were in upscale neighborhoods like Forest Hills and subdivisions in Donelson and Brentwood, all suburbs of Nashville in Middle Tennessee. And the towns spanned three counties, Davidson, Williamson, and Wilson. The homes were often fairly secluded from neighbors or roads. And after he had brutalized his victim, he would run back into the trees behind their homes. He also chose rainy and foggy nights. He always struck between the rainy months of September and March in the darkest hours before dawn. And he didn't leave any evidence behind. The women never saw his face. Some guessed he was Caucasian by his voice, but many were unsure of even his height or weight. That's because he always had the element of surprise. Most victims woke to find him in their rooms, even on their beds already. He always wore a mask and would quickly duct tape the eyes of his victims before they could make out any other distinguishing features. And police soon found that the Wooded Rapist rarely left any physical evidence behind. He was controlled, meticulous, and absolutely followed a strict MO, even if his victims were in different age groups. Pat Young, his first victim, as I said, was a 38-year-old attorney in Nashville. She lived alone and had a gun. But Burdick entered her home so quietly and was on top of her before she even knew it. It was pouring rain and 3:50 a.m. She had fallen asleep on her stomach that night, and when she first felt something on her shoulders and neck, she thought it was one of her cats and tried to shove it away. But when she turned her head, she saw Burdick in the light of a low lamp she had on in her bedroom. She immediately began struggling, but he sprawled out over her and pinned her to the mattress. She told police that she kept screaming no and reached back with her right hand and realized he had a stocking over his face. She said he punched her hard in the side of the head and told her to put her hands behind her head, showing her a nylon cord he planned to tie her up with. Pat knew she couldn't let him tie her up, so she kept flailing, and every time he tried to reach under her and grab her hands, she would bite him. And every time she bit him, he punched her in the head and face. She was hit at least 20 times. Eventually, they tumbled off the bed and onto the floor. That's when she realized she had a piece of his skin in her teeth and managed to pull it out of her mouth and stick it under the bed without him knowing. His assault continued and he pressed his hand against her vaginal area. He was never able to penetrate with his hand or his penis, and as she kept screaming and fighting, he appeared to give up. He forced her into her bathroom and told her to stay there for 5 minutes, and then he left. Pat waited a few moments and then came out, grabbed the handgun she had stashed in her bedside table, and called 911. Though Pat was armed, Burdick had managed to sneak in and overpower her before she could get to her gun. When officers got to the house, they were unable to track Burdick's scent with the canine unit. I think it's possible this is one reason why he chose rainy nights. Police did find his point of entry, though. Pat had an unlocked window in her garage. He had slit the screen and came in that way. But they found no other physical evidence at the scene. He had left nothing behind, except that piece of skin he didn't know about. The police were even able to develop a partial print from the skin, but it didn't match anyone in their database. They sent the scan to the TBI, who were able to develop a DNA profile, but it didn't match any profiles already in CODIS. So far, the wooded rapist was a ghost. If he had offended before, he had been just as careful. And considering how brutal his next attacks would be, he was certainly learning. I've wondered why he decided to give up with Pat and walk away, but I think it's just how ferociously she was fighting back. He may have also realized he was bleeding and the chances of leaving DNA were too great, so he cut and ran. Pat Young was and is an amazing woman. She even showed up at work the next morning, startling her receptionist with her horribly bruised and swollen face. But she refused to be intimidated. She refused to let the attack define her life. She has always told the press to use her name. And this was a different time in 1994. She told Keith Morrison of Dateline that friends and acquaintances didn't really know how to deal with it. She was completely open about what had happened to her, and one ignorant woman at a work Christmas party asked her if it had been good for her too, basically making a joke out of the vicious attack Pat had suffered. But because Pat refused to remain silent, she became an advocate for the victims who would follow, and there would be many. At this time, I'm going to pause for a short commercial break. Behind every hostage situation you've watched on the news is a complex dynamic between hostage, captor, and negotiator. One wrong word or move, and the hostage could lose their life. Every Thursday, the podcast Hostage from the Parcast Network tells the extraordinary stories behind the world's most famous hostage situations and the people involved with them. Hostage explores the psychological tactics used by negotiators and how the human psyche reacts to being held captive. Find out how these intense situations arise and how negotiators find a peaceful resolution. Hostage highlights the moments where things went tragically wrong, as well as the strategies that heroically saved lives. Check out the thrilling three-part on the Patty Hearst kidnapping, and don't miss the incredible two-part episode on Captain Phillips, the case made famous by the Tom Hanks movie. Search for and subscribe to Hostage wherever you listen to podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review. The next time Burdick attacked a woman was on November 20th, 1998, 4 years after Pat Young's attack. Pat had been attacked on March 1st, but this November night, 4 years later, was just as rainy and chilly and also foggy. He broke in a rear window of a house on Otter Creek Road in Forest Hills. It was 1 a.m. He surprised a 22-year-old woman sleeping in one of the bedrooms. For the first time, he used duct tape. He bound her wrists with it and also covered up her eyes with the tape. The woman was 7 months pregnant, and it wasn't actually her home. She was a home health caregiver for an elderly couple that owned the house. In this attack, Burdick wore a ski mask and carried both a gun and knife, and he also unplugged the phone. He raped the victim vaginally and then removed the duct tape and ran back into the backyard through the trees. But he again had left his DNA. This time on his victim. It was matched to Pat Young's sample fairly quickly. I wonder about the 4-year gap between this young woman's rape and the attack on Pat Young. It's possible that there are other victims, or maybe Pat spooked him enough that he backed off for a while. There's no way to be sure. But he wouldn't wait long for his next attack. On December 29, 1998, just a little over a month since the second attack, Burdick crept up to a house on Priest Road, right around the corner from Otter Creek Road, the scene of his last attack. Again, there was heavy rain and fog, and the 36-year-old woman living there had noticed that the garage light was on. When she stepped outside to turn it off, he grabbed her from behind, brandishing a knife. She fought hard, and Burdick wound up slicing her left ring finger down to the bone in the struggle. He eventually gave up and ran away, again into the tree line. I think it's possible this time he was spooked by the victim's screams. They were outside, and it was more likely that someone would hear. And so he was gone, into the night again. Burdick was tied to this attempted rape by the victim's description of his ski mask, the method he used to attack, the place, as it was so close to his last attack, and by the weather conditions that night. Jason Burdick's next attack would show that he was becoming more bold and more depraved. Just 3 months after the Priest Road attempted rape, on March 31, 1999, he walked into an open garage door in a home in Moreland States in Brentwood. A 48-year-old woman was home alone and was expecting her teenage daughters at any moment. This attack was not in the pre-dawn hours. It was around 7:30 in the evening. She was startled to see the man in black with a ski mask. Before she had time to react, her daughters did come through the door, bringing the Chinese food they had gone out for. Burdick held a gun on the mother and her two daughters and ordered the youngest one into another room. He bound the mother and 16-year-old's wrists with plastic ties and covered their eyes with duct tape. He then digitally raped both the mother and daughter before fleeing into another rainy and foggy night. As he had penetrated the victims with his fingers, there was no DNA in this case, but his MO was becoming easy to spot. The only difference this time was the time of night and the daughters walking in unexpectedly. Police dogs were able to track a scent near the woods behind the home, but it ended at a dirt road, probably where he had parked his car. Jason Burdick was fine-tuning his MO now. His next attack would show even more sophistication. On Reagan Run Road in Antioch on September 9, 1999, he cut through a screen and climbed into an open window at around 4 a.m. He had used a chair from a neighbor's porch to reach the window. The 45-year-old woman in bed said she awoke when he jumped on top of her. He turned her over roughly, pushing her face into the pillow. As usual, he put duct tape over her eyes, but this time also over her mouth. And he used wire ties to bind her hands. The victim said his gloves smelled of oil or gas. She said he poked the tip of the knife into her face, further terrorizing her, before cutting off her t-shirt and underwear and vaginally raping her. He cut her free and then told her to go get in the shower. This is the first time he would instruct a victim to shower, and it would become part of his calling card. This was also the first time he cut a phone line, as the victim discovered when she went to call 911. But even with the shower, he had left DNA. It's unclear if he used a condom in this attack. This one didn't go to trial, and there is less detail. But his DNA was positively matched to the previous assaults. 2 months later, on November 2, 1999, at 1:30 a.m., he broke into a home in the Foxland Hall subdivision in Brentwood on another rainy and foggy night. A 16-year-old girl named Zaya Miller woke up to a gun being held to her temple. She said that she saw a set of eyes, a mask, and a hand covering her mouth. He said, "Don't talk or I'll kill you." While her parents slept, he held a gun to Zaya's head and walked her to the detached garage up the road from her home. He put duct tape over her eyes and mouth, though the tape was slipping because Zaya's hair was wet from the rain. He forcibly stripped her and then raped her vaginally. She cried during the assault, asking, "Why are you doing this?" He replied, "Because I've been watching you and you're pretty." When it was over, he told her to run back to her house. She ran through the pouring rain, terrified the whole time that he would shoot her in the back. It was just one day before her 17th birthday. She had only recently moved to the area with her family. Jason Burdick shattered her young life. Zaya Miller has always allowed the press to use her name. Like Pat Young, she was open and angry. She said that she refused to accept the shame for being a victim. And again, while no other evidence was left and she didn't get a good look at Burdick, he left his DNA in her underwear. By now, the police and public were aware that there was a serial rapist operating in the greater Nashville area. And worried about the statute of limitations for Pat Young, a prosecutor named Rita Brockman Baker filed an affidavit of complaint against a John Doe with the Davidson County General Sessions Court. She attached his DNA profile, and the warrant was issued on February 2nd of 2000. His next attack, just 16 days later, would terrorize a whole family. At a Tusculum Road home in South Nashville, a 55-year-old woman woke suddenly in the middle of a thunderstorm and realized there was a man standing in her room. It was 3:15 in the morning. Her screams brought her 29-year-old daughter, who had been sleeping in another room, running in. She had three small children, aged 3, 5, and 6, who were asleep in a third bedroom. When she saw the man standing in her mother's room, she bolted to get the phone. But the line was dead. Burdick had cut the phone line outside. And then she heard her mother's voice on the other side of the locked door. Burdick had a gun to her mother's head, so the 29-year-old woman unlocked the door. The man was wearing dark clothing and a ski mask. He was tall and built, athletic-looking. Burdick then duct-taped their eyes and tied their wrists with plastic ties. First, he laid the grandmother in the floor and moved the young mother to the bed, but then he heard the children moving around in the next room. So he sent the grandmother into the children's room to keep them quiet. She later told the Tennessean newspaper that the children asked why she had tape on her eyes, but she ignored the question and told them to sing with her. The three kids sang songs of worship with their Nana while their mother endured a brutal rape in the next room. The 29-year-old single mom was a songwriter and newly divorced. She had been adopted and had just reunited with her birth mother. Both women later said they were so grateful that she was in the home that night, with the younger woman calling her birth mom, "My Angel." After the assault was over, Burdick instructed the young woman to get in the shower. Making the women shower was a central part to his MO. He was smart. He used condoms, and yet he still knew enough about DNA to force the women to shower. But the plan wasn't foolproof. Yet again, he left his DNA on the victim. These victims also reported that he smelled of car oil or gas. After Burdick put the young mother in the shower, he left. And once she was sure he was gone, she started singing to let her mother know it was over. The grandmother ran to the bathroom and they cut each other free before calling the police. And he ran out again into the night. But this time, police dogs were able to track him as far as a parking lot at the Hickory Glade condominiums. They believe his car was parked there, but he got away before they found him. And so his reign of terror continued. I'm going to pause now for a word from one of our sponsors. One of our sponsors for today's episode is a company I have fallen in love with. It's called Beauty by Design. I don't know about you guys, but I struggle finding the right skincare products. The choices are overwhelming, whether you're at your local drugstore or a high-end beauty counter. It's expensive and frustrating to keep trying products when I'm really not sure what's right for my skin type. Beauty by Design took the guesswork out. Beauty by Design connects you with an online esthetician who will diagnose your skin for just $15 and then curate the perfect mix of vegan, cruelty-free, natural products just for you. And you can do it all via text message. In under 2 minutes, I answered a few questions about my skin, gave my price point, and sent them a makeup-free selfie. My esthetician, Veronica, explained that my oily skin was a mixed blessing from my olive complexion. I need to control the oil in places and moisturize in others. I ordered the skin regimen she suggested, and I am loving the results. Beauty by Design is not a subscription service. You're not locked into anything. You order only the products you need when you need them, and shipping and returns are always free. If you've ever been overwhelmed by the skincare options out there, I can't recommend Beauty by Design enough, especially if you're looking for healthier and more natural products perfectly tailored for your skin. To experience the world's most personalized skincare, go to beautybydesign.com/southernfried and use promo code southernfried. First-time customers get 20% off. That's beautybydesign.com/southernfried and use promo code southernfried to get 20% off your first personalized order. And thanks so much to Beauty by Design for sponsoring today's show. After the February 2000 rape of the 29-year-old woman whose mother and children were in the house, the wooded rapist was quiet for a few years. It's entirely possible, in fact probable, that he was still offending and victims did not come forward. Pat Young often mentioned this in the press over the years, that one of the reasons she revealed her name and stayed so public in the case was to encourage other victims to come forward. At this point, we may never know. Over a decade has passed since his last offense, and no one else has come forward, or police haven't connected any other cases. It's also possible he moved further out of the greater Nashville area. He could have crossed the line into Kentucky for that matter, throwing off the pattern for police. But back to our timeline, the wooded rapist's next documented attack was on November 3, 2004. At around midnight, a 46-year-old woman called K.A. in trial transcripts had fallen asleep in the great room of her home in the Meadow Lake subdivision of Brentwood. A great room is like a more open living room, and there were French doors without blinds that were unlocked that looked into the room. Her daughter had fallen asleep around 9 p.m., and her husband went to bed then too. She had stayed up to watch television and fell asleep on the couch. She awoke to the feeling of a hand on her face. A hand in fingerless gloves. He put his hand over her eyes and said, "Shush, don't say anything." He then told her to get up and go to the doors to the deck. Worried for her husband and daughter, the victim, dressed only in a white nightgown, complied. She later said she tried to remain calm and not look directly at her attacker so she wouldn't seem confrontational. As they walked onto the deck, she said he pulled her out of the door and she anxiously said, "I just want my family to be safe." And he responded with something like, "They will be if you just come with me." She said he guided her down the deck steps and told her to go down near the creek line on the eastern edge of her property. The location he was pointing to was fairly remote from her house and from neighbors. It had been another rainy evening, though the rain had stopped. It was overcast and the ground was wet and muddy. The victim later testified she was so petrified that she urinated on herself while walking towards the creek. When they got there, Burdick pushed her to the ground face first, covered her eyes with duct tape, and then ordered her to undress. He told her to lie down on the ground, and she did, but then he unzipped his pants and jerked her back partially upright and ordered her to perform fellatio on him. She said he told her, "Don't fuck it up, you know what to do." She said after 3 or 4 minutes, he finally withdrew his penis from her mouth. But then she heard him open a condom wrapper. He put on the condom and then leaned over and kissed her, jamming his tongue into her mouth. Then he kissed her breasts. She realized then that he was wearing a wool ski mask with an opening for his mouth. She said he forced her to lay flat on the ground and climbed on top of her, raping her vaginally. He used his saliva for lubrication. While he was raping her, he told her to kiss him and also kept kissing her breasts. She later testified that she remained compliant, fearing if she didn't, the situation would spiral out of control. He continued raping her for 5 or 6 minutes and then withdrew abruptly when they heard a dog barking nearby. Burdick again shushed her and told her to get dressed. After she pulled on her nightgown, he guided her towards her house. She still had duct tape over her eyes and held her arms out in front of her, trying not to fall. He pushed her to the bottom step of her deck stairs and then told her to pull off the duct tape, go up the steps, inside the house, don't look back, and wait to call the police. And then, like the ghost he had always been, he slipped back into the shadows, disappearing into the tree line. The victim said she first went and checked on her daughter and the girl was still sleeping. Then she woke up her husband and told him what had happened. They went into the den rather than the great room, now that it felt too open to her, to call the police. Though she didn't so much as wash her hands or take a drink of water, she did smoke a cigarette, trying to calm herself down. She testified that she wanted to make sure everything was preserved. The police and paramedics were at her house within minutes. The ambulance took her, still in her nightgown, covered with mud and debris, to the emergency room. Once there, the staff had her undress over a plastic sheet to catch any debris. They photographed her, performed a rape kit, collecting swabs from her mouth, the skin of her breast, and her vagina. When the victim's husband talked to police, he explained that they had motion detectors on the lights on their deck. After the rape, they found that the bulbs had been loosened. Since she was asleep when Burdick entered her home, there's no way to be sure that the lights would have made a difference, but it definitely shows a certain level of planning on his part. We learned from the attack on Zaya Miller that he watched his victims, probably all of them, learning their routine and knew the best time to strike. The TBI lab tested her rape kit and also her nightgown, but didn't find any evidence of semen. This isn't necessarily unusual. There also was no DNA found on the oral swabs she gave, despite the forced fellatio. However, swabs from the victim's breast, which Burdick had kissed, did contain DNA in his saliva. And it was matched to all of the previous attacks. There was no question. It was the wooded rapist, back after 4 years. And as for that dog barking, that was her neighbor's boyfriend, who had spent the night next door and had taken his dog out to go to the bathroom. He saw the victim on the ground and a man standing over her. Though he thought it was odd, she didn't seem in distress, and he assumed it was the victim and her husband outside. When they quickly got up and went inside after the dog barked, he was even more sure. He just didn't realize that Burdick didn't go inside as well. But the next morning, when he saw the police cars at the house, he realized what he had really seen. He immediately went next door and told the officers what he had seen. There was now an eyewitness besides the victim. Unfortunately, due to the dark night and Burdick's dark clothing, he didn't get a good look at him and would not be able to positively identify him. Still, his story definitely supported the victims. After this attack, Burdick seemed to be spooked again. There are two other cases linked to him in June 2005 and August 2006. Both attacks were on Otter Creek Road. He had already hit this area twice. The second rape on record was on Otter Creek Road, and the third, which was an attempted rape of the 36-year-old woman on Priest Road, is just around the corner from Otter Creek. The differences in these two attempted rapes is that they occurred in summer months. This was a first. By now, the wooded rapist stories were all over the media. Women were warned to be alert during the cold, rainy months. Maybe he decided to change the time of year because of the publicity. But he was stupid enough to stay in the same area, on the exact same road. In the June 2005 attempted rape, he broke into the home of a 26-year-old woman who managed to fight him off. In the August 2006 attempted rape, he attacked a woman in her front yard. Her fighting and screams scared him off. There is not DNA in these cases because, thankfully, he was not able to rape the women. But other than being during the summer, everything else matched. His clothing, his mask, even the smell of oil and gas on his gloves. And obviously, Otter Creek was his favorite street to haunt. Even though the attacks were spread apart, he seemed to be losing control. He lost control of the situation both times, and perhaps these attacks were not as well planned. Otter Creek Road was actually only 20 minutes from Jason Burdick's home on Ash Grove Court in South Nashville. Otter Creek Road happens to sit next to Radnor Lake and Radnor State Park. It seems likely that is why he focused on this area. The woods of the park were a good cover. And Priest Road, the site of his third attack, the attempted rape of the 36-year-old woman, is only 6 minutes from Otter Creek Road. In April of 2006, no closer to catching the wooded rapist, a Davidson County grand jury issued a multi-count indictment charging John Doe, aka the wooded rapist, with 5 counts of aggravated rape and 6 counts of aggravated burglary. The statute of limitations was running out for victims like Pat Young. For the burglary charges and attempted rapes, the statute is anywhere from 2 to 9 years. It's 15 years for aggravated rape. When the grand jury indicted the John Doe wooded rapist, he had been active for 12 years. Pat Young was already covered by the previous criminal affidavit filed, but the district attorney's office wanted to be sure they could get him for every attack. John Doe warrants and indictments are becoming more and more common. If there is a serial offender on a rampage, but he's never been caught, the DA has to do something to stop the clock. These John Doe indictments started in the 1990s when DNA was a burgeoning science. And there were many skeptics at the time. People just didn't trust the science, or in some cases, the methods of collecting DNA. These people were generally defense attorneys. Burdick's own attorney would later make many comments to the press about challenging the DNA findings in his cases. But when push came to shove at the trials, he dropped the matter. But back to the timeline. On December 27, 2006, another woman on Otter Creek Road was raped after he broke into her home. This was now 5 attacks on Otter Creek Road alone. And then, he ostensibly went dormant again for nearly a year. Like I said, it is possible there are other victims who never came forward. On November 18, 2007, a 61-year-old widowed woman who lived alone in Donelson, another Nashville suburb, had fallen asleep on her couch while watching television. Around midnight, she woke up to a man's voice directly behind her telling her to get up. She wasn't wearing her glasses and the room was dark, but she could see the man from a light from an adjoining room. He wore his usual ski mask, which she actually clarified was a stocking cap with the holes cut out for his eyes, nose, and mouth. He also wore a dark hoodie and pants. When she stood up, he put duct tape over her eyes and told her to undress. She complied, later explaining that all she was trying to do was make it out of this ordeal alive. He duct taped her wrists and then pushed her to the floor. He kissed her, jamming his tongue in her mouth, and also kissed her breasts. He told her he would use a condom, and she heard him open the wrapper. He then put a finger in her rectum and raped her vaginally with his penis. She begged him to loosen the tape on her wrists, which was very painful, but he refused. She wasn't sure how many minutes the assault lasted or if he ejaculated. She said he just eventually stopped and told her to get up. He walked her to a shower that was on the opposite end of her house. When they got there, he did cut the tape from her wrists and instructed her to get into the shower. He told her to stay there for 10 minutes, and then he left. But this victim, like Pat Young and others, was determined to preserve the evidence. She knew he had used a condom, so when he didn't watch her in the shower, she left the water running but didn't stand underneath the stream. This was crucial. The DNA evidence in her case came from the saliva found from the swabs of her breasts taken at the ER. But she went a step further. When she got out of the shower, she took 2 of her own cotton swabs, or Q-tips, and swabbed the inside of her mouth and put them into a plastic baggie. Burdick's lawyers would take issue with this, screaming contamination, but the chain of evidence from the ER proved that the DNA was actually derived from the rape kit and the swabs performed there. Like most of the victims, she noticed the mask and noticed more detail than some, but as far as the rest of his appearance, she was at a loss. She just knew that he was taller than her and of average weight. She was not even sure of his race, but told police she believed it was a white man due to his speaking voice. The 61-year-old grandmother did not fight. She wanted to make sure she lived. But she fought like hell to preserve the evidence. Her quick thinking and calmness once again preserved the DNA needed to put this bastard away. But sadly, he wasn't finished yet. On February 1st, 2008, Burdick raped a 16-year-old girl outside of her home on Highway 109 in Wilson County. And this wasn't his only Wilson County rape either. I am unsure of the date for this assault as it did not go to trial and is only mentioned briefly in most newspapers. Jason Burdick raped the 14-year-old niece of an ex-girlfriend he had babysat for. He didn't assault her while babysitting, but broke into her Wilson County home after. Then he actually took the niece and her family to dinner a few weeks later, boldly betting that he would not be recognized. He wasn't. It wasn't until after the publicity of the other rapes that his sexual assault on this child was tied to him. At 14, she was Burdick's youngest victim, with the 61-year-old Donelson woman being his oldest. His choice of victims seemed to have more to do with convenience, whether it was close to his home or remote homes that he had been watching. This was now 14 attacks attributed to the mysterious wooded rapist. 3 of these were attempted rapes. 1 of these was a dual attack on a woman and her 16-year-old daughter. 1 rape was of the 29-year-old woman whose mother and children were in the home. The wooded rapist had no qualms or trouble controlling more than one victim at a time. He may not have planned those attacks that way, but he still managed the situation, further traumatizing the victims as he terrorized their families as well. Metro Nashville police were on high alert. Every rainy night, patrol officers were reminded to be on the lookout for any suspicious men out in the weather. The media was in overdrive reporting the attacks, and women everywhere in Middle Tennessee were terrified. But his time was coming. His luck was running out. At this time, I'm going to pause to hear a final word from one of our sponsors. After midnight on April 29, 2008, just 3 months after his last rape of the 16-year-old girl in Wilson County, a Michigan couple that were visiting their children were asleep in their RV. The RV was parked in their daughter's driveway in Brentwood. It was in the Meadow Lake subdivision, where Burdick had raped the 46-year-old woman outside of her house in her backyard near a creek line in November of 2004. Burdick seemed to be comfortable returning to the same neighborhoods. But on this night, he came across something he wasn't expecting. As he crept near the house where the RV was parked, a dog started barking loudly. It was coming from the RV. Doug and Sharon Kuehler were woken when their small mixed-breed shaggy dog, named Bailey, started barking ferociously. Sharon looked out a window and saw a man standing near the camper. She yelled, "Hey!" and he turned around and she saw that he was wearing a mask. He then shined a flashlight into the window of the RV and growled. He actually growled in fury, and then he walked off in the direction of Williamsburg Road. The Kuehlers called 911 and the police were there within 5 minutes. They swarmed the neighborhood but didn't find anyone. Brentwood Patrol Officer Elliot Hamm drove around until he saw a Jeep Grand Cherokee parked on the street. It stuck out as odd in this neighborhood where no cars were parked on the street. He got out and felt the hood and it was still warm. He looked inside and saw a red hat, a black bag, and several drink containers. So he waited and watched. About an hour later, Officer Hamm spotted Burdick walking in the neighborhood. He may have hid for a while, then hoping it was clear, and started walking quickly to his car. Officer Hamm did not stop him while he was on foot, but followed him until he got into the Jeep and started driving out of the neighborhood. Then he pulled him over. He asked Burdick what he was doing there, and he claimed he had been at a house party at the home of a man named Ricky Douglas. Burdick was wearing camouflage pants, a gray t-shirt with cut-off sleeves, running shoes, and the red hat the officer had spotted earlier. He was 5'11" tall and about 200 pounds with a muscular build. He had brown hair and blue eyes, and he was visibly nervous at being stopped. Officer Hamm asked if he could search the Jeep, but Burdick refused. Because he didn't have anything on Burdick but walking in the neighborhood where the complaint was made, he had to let him go. But he did go to the home of Ricky Douglas and confirmed that there was no house party, and furthermore, there was room in the driveway for a Jeep. But now, they had a name and a license plate number. They had him. Metro Nashville police started 24-hour surveillance of Jason Burdick. While he was running errands one day and his Jeep was parked in a public parking lot, they placed a GPS tracker on it. His lawyers later argued strenuously at pretrial hearings about use of the GPS tracker violating their client's Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure. But because police waited to place the tracker until Burdick was in public, they were within the letter of the law and the matter was dropped at trial by Burdick's attorneys. But in 2 days, with the GPS on his Jeep, the police waited and tracked Burdick. Finally, he went to a restaurant called TG's in Laverne. They waited until he left and then retrieved a silverware, a plate, and a cup he had used. They fast-tracked the items to the TBI lab, and within 24 hours, they had a DNA profile. It was a match. Finally, the wooded rapist had been officially unmasked. He was arrested as soon as the lab tests were back on May 1st. He was charged with 6 counts of aggravated rape and attempted rape based on DNA from numerous victims. On May 2nd, police executed a search warrant on his home and car. A roll of green duct tape as well as several condoms were found in his Jeep. Burdick lived in a duplex on Ashgrove Court in South Nashville. Investigators found ski masks, flashlights, camouflage clothing, anti-dog barking devices, cameras, gloves, knives, and 5 guns with multiple boxes of ammunition. One gun, a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol, was found in a box with 13 condoms. They also found rape-themed pornography, including DVDs titled Rape is a Circle and Women Behind Bars. The Women Behind Bars DVD is interesting because Robert Jason Burdick had at one time applied to the Department of Corrections for Davidson County. It's not clear why his application was turned down, but when he applied, he was fingerprinted, and the print that was developed from the piece of skin Pat Young had bitten off and preserved was a match. Now they had DNA and a fingerprint match. So who was this Robert Jason Burdick? The man who had terrorized so many women and towns across 3 counties for 14 years. He was apparently adopted at birth by a couple from Clarksville, Tennessee, and he has one sister. He had been a high school football player, graduated from Clarksville High School in 1988, and then attended Austin Peay University for about a year. At the time of his arrest, he was 38 years old and one of the principal owners of a company called WB Technologies, which sold burglar alarm systems. It's never explicitly addressed in court or in the press, but the homes Burdick chose didn't seem to have burglar alarms. There is nothing about him bypassing systems. It was probably another factor in choosing these particular houses. Jason Burdick seemingly had no criminal record, and friends and family were stunned. Those are the literal headlines of the Times. Friends of wooded rapists stunned at his arrest. One old girlfriend named Gretchen Glaze gave extensive interviews about Burdick. Glowing accounts of his exemplary life, growing up in a, quote, loving Christian household. "This has hit me like a ton of bricks," she wailed to the Tennessean. She and Burdick had dated from 2005 to 2006 before she moved away to Laverne. The dates are interesting to me because that was a slower time for the serial rapist. Those years, he had only 2 attempted rapes at odd times in the summer. Maybe some of the gaps in his attacks could be attributed to relationships. Glaze said he had already been married and divorced before they dated. His ex-wife is a school teacher. And he was evidently considered quite the catch. He was handsome and involved in the community. He even was auctioned off as an eligible bachelor at a charity gala for Habitat for Humanity, raising almost $10,000. One of the organizers characterized him as handsome, outgoing, fun, and confident. Habitat for Humanity's spokesman said they were shocked and brokenhearted. Gretchen Glaze said that while she was shocked and disappointed, she still planned on reaching out to both Jason and his family. "I swear, these women that will excuse and flock around accused rapists just kill me. I understand that she knew him, and I can even understand wanting the attention of going to the press, but expressing support for an accused serial rapist is disgusting. I didn't find interviews with her after the trial, so maybe she finally woke up to what he really was after he was repeatedly convicted." And at this point, all the police knew were that he had a few speeding tickets. But they would find out that Jason Burdick's past wasn't as bright and shiny as had been portrayed. Back in his hometown was another ex-girlfriend who didn't remember him fondly. She told Dateline that he always had a reputation and that he had been in trouble for vandalism. Her name is Angela Greer, and she said Jason Burdick was her first true love. They dated when they were 16 years old and sophomores at Clarksville High School. He was popular, came from an upstanding family that was in church every week. He was extremely social, as well as being a celebrated athlete. The two broke up after an ugly, violent incident at a mall. She caught him cheating on her, walking around holding hands with another girl. She said that she walked up to the other girl and said, "If you're smart, you'll run," at which Burdick turned around, grabbed her by her hair, and punched her directly in the face. The left side of her face was completely bruised and swollen. She pressed charges for the assault. He was sent to the Spencer Youth Detention Center in Nashville. She couldn't remember how much time he spent there, but she did remember that he missed Christmas. And worse, his family didn't just support him, they were cruel to Angela. They blamed her for the incident, and they collected every gift she had ever brought them or Jason and dumped it on her front porch. Yeah, they sound like a great Christian family, pillars of the community. But that wasn't all. Angela said most of Clarksville ostracized her after the incident. She took down their golden boy. She said someone even set fire to her yard, though they were never caught. But after he got out of Spencer, his juvenile record was sealed and these early crimes were largely forgotten. Current neighbors of Jason Burdick's on Ashgrove Court talked to the papers and said he was an odd guy. One woman said he would often come over and talk to her late at night if he saw her on her porch. She thought it was inappropriate and was uncomfortable, but he was friendly enough, so she blew it off. A much clearer picture of the real Jason Burdick was emerging. He graduated from vandalism to violent assault on his ex-girlfriend when he was still just a teenager. But it seems after his time at Spencer, he kept his nose clean. At least publicly. Burdick's meticulous methods are reminiscent to me of the Golden State Killer. He started out with petty vandalism and then moved on to more violent crimes. He carefully struck on dark, rainy nights, only homes that were well off the road and close to wooded areas. He was careful to not be recognized, not only wearing the ski mask, but by duct taping his victims' eyes. And while it doesn't seem that he targeted families or couples, once confronted with the situation, he didn't hesitate. And he terrorized victims, holding his knife to their face, telling them he would kill them if they didn't cooperate. He also watched his victims, staking out their homes. He didn't target a particular type of woman, age or otherwise, but it was the remoteness of locations that seemed to be why he chose them. And as his victims were getting younger and he was getting more bold, it would seem that he was escalating. It did take 14 years to get him. But then, they may have gotten him before he moved on to murder. Robert Jason Burdick was put on trial 5 times, from April 2009 to May 2010. His first trial was his oldest victim, the 61-year-old Donaldson woman he had raped. He was tried for 2 counts of aggravated rape and 1 count of aggravated burglary. The 61-year-old victim made an excellent witness. She had total recall of that horrific night in November of 2007. And they had the DNA he had left on her breast that she had preserved by staying out of the water when he put her in the shower. The jury deliberated less than 2 hours, handing down a sentence totaling 32 years, 16 years each for both counts of rape and 3 years for the burglary charge. District Attorney Roger Moore praised the woman, saying she was a role model. Her preservation of evidence was crucial. And sitting right behind her for the duration of the trial, putting a comforting hand on her shoulder, was none other than Pat Young, Burdick's first victim. She attended every trial in support. She was vocal in the press. She is a warrior. And it was her trial that was next, beginning in October of 2009. She also was an incredible witness at her own trial. She had total recall from the attempted rape and vicious beating she suffered that cold and rainy night more than 14 years before. The DNA in her case was the first DNA they ever had on Burdick, and she had fought hard for it, biting his hand and then hiding the skin. That also produced a print that matched Jason Burdick. The jury was out about 3 hours on her case. There had been many questions from the jury because he had been charged with aggravated rape and attempted aggravated rape. They settled on the attempted rape charge, found him guilty, and sentenced him to 10 years. The third trial was for the 46-year-old victim known as K.A. She had been attacked in her Williamsburg Road home in the Meadow Lake subdivision of Brentwood, where he took her outside to the creek line, forced her to fellate him, before vaginally raping her. He was charged with aggravated rape, aggravated kidnapping, and burglary. He was sentenced to 12 years each on the rape and kidnapping charges and 6 on the burglary, for a total of 30 years. Jason Burdick's next trial was in March of 2010, and it was for the rape of the 29-year-old mother of 3, whose mother had been in the home at the time and kept the kids in another room. Burdick bound and terrorized both women, though the grandmother was able to keep the kids from knowing what was going on. The woman who was raped was so traumatized that she moved out of state, even though she had just recently moved to the Nashville area to be closer to her adoptive parents and her birth mother, who was with her through the ordeal. There was also a positive DNA match in her case. Burdick was charged with aggravated rape and especially aggravated kidnapping in this case, and the jury handed down a verdict of 20 years. And now, it was Zaya Miller's turn. It was the fifth trial, and the girl who was 16 at the time of the rape was now an incredibly well-spoken 26-year-old young woman. She was another terrific witness with excellent recall of the brutality she had suffered more than a decade before when Burdick had forced her out of her home to a garage and raped her. She didn't cry on the stand, but she did when the verdict was read. She had spoken eloquently to the press while the jury was deliberating, saying, quote, "I would just love, for my own personal edification, to have him sentenced at the maximum. I have to live with this to the fullest, and so does he. I don't get to escape out of this any earlier in my life, so neither should he. I would love to see 2 25-year sentences served consecutively." She got her wish. The jury deliberated only an hour before handing down the 50-year verdict. Burdick had originally pled guilty in this trial, but withdrew his plea at the last moment. Between the DNA found on Zaya's underwear and her articulate and persuasive testimony, he never had a chance anyway. Now that Burdick was facing a total of 142 years, with 102 years before he would be eligible for parole from the first five trials, the district attorney went to the other victims and asked if they would be all right with retiring the rest of the cases. Yes, it would save a lot of taxpayer dollars, but it would also spare the rest of his victims from being re-traumatized by testifying at trial. Though they are all survivors, not all of them felt as strong as the women who had already convicted Burdick. They wanted to put it behind them. Jason Burdick would never see the light of day, so everyone was in agreement. Everyone, that is, but Jason Burdick. He swiftly fired his defense team and filed an appeal for a new trial on Zaya Miller's case. He merely told the judge that he was unhappy with his representation, and the public defender's office was designated to represent him on the cases out of Wilson County that hadn't gone to trial yet. It was the remaining Davidson County cases that had been retired. But the Wilson County cases were eventually retired as well. Robert Jason Burdick is currently serving his sentence at the Northwest Tennessee Correctional Facility in Lake County. But it's not the last we would hear from him. In February of 2016, he went before a Williamson County judge asking that charges that had not yet been tried to be expunged from his record. There was another rape case and numerous burglary charges still pending in Williamson County. He told the judge that, quote, "When there is a pending charge, there are certain programs I'm not entitled to in prison." But his request was put on hold because he hasn't yet completed his post-conviction relief, meaning he still has years of appeals to get through before this would be considered, or the Williamson County DA will choose to litigate the remaining charges. And the wooded rapist cases had even further reaching implications in Tennessee. In February of 2014, the Tennessean, along with a coalition of other press outlets like the Chattanooga Times Free Press and the Associated Press, filed a lawsuit against Metro Nashville Police and Vanderbilt University because they had been denied access that was typically available under public records laws during the Big Vanderbilt rape trial. I plan to cover that case one day as well. A young woman was gang raped in a Vanderbilt dorm by four football players. The wooded rapist was brought into the argument for the press, citing the need for public knowledge. If the police could control what and when the press had access to, they could potentially put the public at danger by not warning them about predators like Jason Burdick. It took 14 years to catch Burdick, and public awareness was crucial. Essentially, the reason for the lawsuit is a bill proposed for a rape shield law that the Tennessean and other news outlets said was unnecessary as they did not name rape victims as a practice. The headline on the Tennessean after the bill was proposed was, quote, "Bill that would shield rape information smacks of spite." The Tennessean insisted the bill was proposed after their lawsuit in order to get even with the news organizations. The paper said that details of sexual assault crimes should be published to warn the public. The bill was proposed just days after the lawsuit was filed, but legislators insisted it had been in the works for years before the lawsuit. And I must admit, it does smack of sour grapes on the part of the Tennessean and other news organizations. They were trying to get access to video footage of the Vanderbilt victim, photos, and text messages, though they later amended their request to just the text messages. The victim, along with several victim advocate agencies, released statements in support of the bill and against the lawsuit. She wanted her privacy protected, as is her right. Ultimately, the Tennessee Supreme Court ruled against the Tennessean and the Media Coalition in a 4-1 vote. Justice Holly Kirby wrote a scathing opinion on the case, warning how detrimental too much access could be to the justice system. Quote, "Citizens who report crimes privately could be outed. Confidential police information sources could be revealed. Police efforts to keep the details of a crime and its investigation secret until the perpetrator is apprehended would be for naught. Victims of sexual crimes could find their personal information as well as videos and photos of their ordeal readily available to those who would post the information online or otherwise further torment them," she wrote. And I don't disagree with her or this decision. As someone who researches true crime, I would rather have easier access to records, but not to the detriment of victims and ongoing investigations. The Nashville police were diligent in publicizing details about the wooded rapist to make sure the public was aware. They warned about the time of night, the weather, and even some of his MO. The public has a right to know when there is a predator in their midst, and that will not change. Incidentally, the Rape Shield bill was also passed. The court held that while the media does play a crucial role in holding the government accountable, the integrity of the investigations and criminal trials could potentially be tainted if defendants and potential jurors could have access to all details before trial. I do understand the Tennessean's point in opposing the bill. As a rule, the media did not publish details about victims, and they felt a Rape Shield law was unnecessary. But if there is even the slightest chance that a son of a bitch like Jason Burdick could get away with even one count of his heinous crimes, I would rather err on the side of preserving the evidence for trial. I do trust our police and government officials to warn the public against predators like Burdick. And serial rapists are not as unusual as you might think. Most men convicted of rape have at least one prior conviction of sexual assault. Studies suggest that upwards of 2/3 of rapists incarcerated are serial rapists. But meticulous and cautious predators like Jason Burdick are unique. Most violent rapists are disorganized and messy. Burdick was obviously aware of police procedure and the importance of DNA. He didn't just wear a mask. He brought condoms. He made women shower. He stalked them, watched their houses, and waited for the most dismal nights of the year to strike, hoping to throw off scent dogs and wash away other trace evidence. It was the brave tenacity of the survivors who fought, who bit, and who used their wits to preserve the DNA he left on their bodies that finally brought this monster down. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm on most large platforms like Stitcher, but you can also listen directly to my network online, Spreaker, or on their app. If you're interested in supporting the show, I have a Patreon page with many different rewards for different levels of donation. Or you could visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, where you can make a one-time donation just by hitting the donate button. I also have stickers, t-shirts, and other merchandise available for sale on the website. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform if you'd like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing this case or any other episodes further, please come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my main Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.